was Jell-O. At the palace on the plains, dessert was almost always Jell-O. If Cook was feeling frisky, you might get Jell-O with little pieces of fruit suspended in it. Carol was doing silverware, and just as the rush began to subside, she wheeled away from the pass-through, shaking with laughter. Her cheeks were bright crimson. What came rolling along the belt was Skip's work. He admitted it later that night, but I knew right away. Although he was in the College of Education and probably destined to teach history and coach baseball at good old Dexter High until he dropped dead of a booze-fueled heart attack at the age of 59 or so, Skip by rights should have been in fine arts. Probably would have been if he hadn't come from five generations of farmers who said, "Ea," and "Cost twill," and "Should smile and kiss a pig." He was only the second or third in his sprawling family. Their religion, Skip once said, was Irish alcoholic, to ever go to college. Clan Kirk could visualize a teacher in the family, barely, but not a painter or a sculptor. And at 18, Skip could see no further than they could. He only knew he didn't quite fit the hole he was trying to slide into, and it made him restless. It made him wander into rooms other than his own, check the LPs, and criticize almost everyone's taste in music. By 1969, he had a better idea of who and what he was. That was the year he constructed a papier-mâché Vietnamese family tableau that was set on fire at the end of a peace rally in front of the Fogler Library, while the Youngbloods played Get Together from a borrowed set of amps and part-time hippies worked out to the beat like tribal warriors after a hunt. You see how jumbled it all is in my mind? It was Atlantis, that's all I know for sure, way down below the ocean. The paper family burned, the hippie protesters chanted, "Napalm, napalm, scum from the skies," as they danced, and after a while the jocks and the frat boys began to throw stuff. Eggs at first, then stones. It was no papier-mâché family that sent Carol laughing and reeling away from the dish line that night in the fall of 1966. It was a horny hot dog man standing atop a Matterhorn of Holyoke Commons baked beans. A pipe cleaner wiener jutted jauntily from the appropriate spot. In his hand was a little University of Maine pennant, on his head a scrap of blue hanky folded to look like a freshman beanie. Along the front of the tray, carefully spelled out in crumbled cornbread, was the message, "Eat more Maine beans." A good deal of edible artwork came along the conveyor belt during my time on the palace dish line, but I think that one was the all-time champ. Stoke Jones would no doubt have called it a waste of time, but I think in that case he would have been wrong. Anything with the power to make you laugh over 30 years later isn't a waste of time. I think something like that is very close to immortality. I punched out at 6:30, walked down the ramp behind the kitchen with one last bag of garbage, and dropped it into one of the four dumpsters lined up behind the commons like snubby steel boxcars. When I turned around, I saw Carol Gerber and a couple of other kids standing by the corner of the building, smoking and watching the moon rise. The other two started away just as I walked over, pulling my Pall Malls out of my jacket pocket. "Hey, Pete, eat more Maine beans," Carol said and laughed. "Yeah." I lit my cigarette. Then, without thinking about it much one way or the other, I said, "There's a couple of Bogart movies playing at Hauk tonight. They start at 7. We've got time to walk over. Want to go?" She smoked, not answering me for a moment, but she was still smiling, and I knew she was going to say yes. Earlier, all I'd wanted was to get back to the third-floor lounge and play hearts. Now that I was away from the game, however, the game seemed a lot less important. Had I been hot enough to say something about beating the snot out of Ronnie Malenfant? It seemed I had. The memory was clear enough. But standing out here in the cool air with Carol, it was hard for me to understand why. "I've got a boyfriend back home," she said at last. "Is that a no?" She shook her head, still with a little smile. The smoke from her cigarette drifted across her face. Her hair, free of the net the girls had to wear on the dish line, blew lightly across her brow. That's information. Remember that show, The Prisoner? Number 6. We want information. I've got a girlfriend back home, I said. More information. I've got another job, tutoring math. I promised to spend an hour tonight with this girl on the second floor. Calculus. Ag. She's hopeless and she whines. But it's $6 an hour. Carol laughed. This is getting good. We're exchanging information like mad. It doesn't look good for Bogey, though, I said. I wasn't worried. I knew we were going to see Bogey. I think I also knew there was romance in our future. It gave me an oddly light feeling, a lifting-off sensation in my midsection. I could call Esther from Hauk and tell her calc at 10 o'clock instead of 9, Carol said. Esther's a sad case. She never goes out. What she does mostly is sit around with her hair in curlers and write letters home about how hard college is. We could see the first movie, at least. That sounds good, I said. We started walking toward Hauk. Those were the days, all right. You didn't have to hire a babysitter, put out the dog, feed the cat, or set the burglar alarm. You just went. Is this like a date? She asked after a little bit. Well, I said, I guess it could be. We were walking past East Annex by then, and other kids were filling up the paths, heading toward the auditorium. Good, she said, because I left my purse back in my room. I can't go Dutch. Don't worry, I'm rich. One big playing cards today. Poker? Hearts, do you know it? Are you kidding? I spent 3 weeks at Camp Winnewanaya on Lake George the summer I was 12. YMCA camp. Poor kids camp, my mom called it. It rained practically every day, and all we did was play hearts and hunt the bitch. Her eyes had gone far away, the way people's eyes do when they trip over some memory like a shoe in the dark. Find the lady in black. Cherchez la femme noire. That's the game, all right, I said, knowing that for a moment I wasn't there for her at all. Then she came back, gave me a grin, and took her cigarettes out of her jeans pocket. We smoked a lot back then. All of us. Back then you could smoke in hospital waiting rooms. I told my daughter that, and at first she didn't believe me. I took out my own cigarettes and lit us both. It was a good moment, the two of us looking at each other in the Zippo's flame. Not as sweet as a kiss, but nice. I felt that lightness inside me again, that sense of lifting off. Sometimes your view widens and grows hopeful. Sometimes you think you can see around corners, and maybe you can. Those are good moments. I snapped my lighter shut, and we walked on, smoking, the backs of our hands close, but not quite brushing. How much money are we talking about? She asked. Enough to run away to California on, or maybe not quite that much? $9. She laughed and took my hand. It's a date, all right, she said. You can buy me popcorn, too. All right. Do you care which movie plays first? She shook her head. Bogey's Bogey. That's true, I said, but I hoped it would be the Maltese Falcon. It was. Halfway through it, while Peter Lorre was doing his rather ominous gay turn, and Bogey was gazing at him with polite, amused incredulity, I looked at Carol. She was looking at me. I bent and kissed her popcorn buttery mouth by the black and white moonlight of John Huston's inspired first film. Her lips were sweet and responsive. I pulled back a little. She was still looking at me. The little smile was back. Then she offered me her bag of popcorn. I reciprocated with my box of dots, and we watched the rest of the movie. Walking back to the Chamberlain King Franklin complex of dorms, I took her hand almost without thinking about it. She curled her fingers through mine naturally enough, but I thought I could feel a reserve now. "Are you going to go back for the Kane Mutiny?" she asked. "You could if you still got your ticket stub, or I could give you mine." "Nah, I've got geology to study." "Bet you wind up playing cards all night instead." "I can't afford to," I said. And I meant it. I meant to go back and study. I really did. Lonely Struggles, or A Scholarship Boy's Life, Carol said. A heartbreaking novel by Charles Dickens. You'll weep as plucky Peter Riley throws himself into the river after finding that the financial aid office has revoked his grant package. I laughed. She was very sharp. I'm in the same boat, you know. If we screw up, maybe we can make it a double suicide. Into the Penobscot with us. Goodbye, cruel world. What's a Connecticut girl doing at the University of Maine anyway, I asked. That's a little complicated. And if you ever plan on asking me out again, you should know you're robbing the cradle. I won't actually be 18 until November. I skipped the 7th grade. That was the year my parents got divorced, and I was miserable. It was either study all the time or turn into one of the Harwich Junior High corner girls. They're the ones who major in French kissing and usually wind up pregnant at 16. You know the kind I mean? Sure. In Gates, you saw them in giggling little groups outside Frank's Fountain or the Dairy Delish, waiting for the boys to come by in their drop Fords and Plymouth Hemis, fast cars with the fender skirts and the decals saying Fram and Quaker State in the back windows. You could see those girls as women down at the other end of Main Street, 10 years older and 40 pounds heavier, drinking beers and shots in Chucky's Tavern. I turned into a study grind. My father was in the Navy. He got out on a disability and moved here to Maine, Damariscotta, down on the coast. I nodded, thinking of Diane Renee's steady boy, the one who said ship ahoy and joined the Navy. I was living in Connecticut with my mother and going to Harwich High. I applied to 16 different schools and got accepted by all but three, but they expected you to pay your own way and you couldn't. She nodded. I think I missed the Plum scholarships by maybe 20 SAT points. An extracurricular activity or two probably wouldn't have hurt either, but I was too busy grinding away at the books. And by then I was pretty hot and heavy with Sully John. The boyfriend, right? She nodded, but not as though this Sully John interested her. The only two schools offering realistic financial aid packages were Maine and UConn. I decided on Maine because by then I wasn't getting along very well with my mother. Lots of fights. You get along better with your father? Hardly ever see him, she said in a dry, business-like tone. He lives with this woman who, well, they drink a lot and fight a lot. Let's leave it at that. But he's a resident of the state, I'm his daughter, and this is a land-grant college. I didn't get everything I needed. UConn offered the better deal, frankly, but I'm not afraid of a little work. It's worth it just to get away. She took a deep breath of the night air and let it out, faintly white. We were almost back to Franklin. Inside the lobby, I could see guys sitting in the hard plastic contour chairs, waiting for their girls to come down from upstairs. It looked like quite a rogues gallery. Worth it just to get away, she had said. Did that mean the mother, the town, and the high school, or was the boyfriend included? When we got to the wide double doors at the front of her dorm, I put my arms around her and bent to kiss her again. She put her hands on my chest, stopping me. Not pulling back, just stopping me. She looked up into my face, smiling that little smile of hers. I could get to love that smile, I thought. It was the kind of smile you might wake up thinking of in the middle of the night. The blue eyes and the blonde hair, too, but mostly the smile. The lips only curved a little, but the corners of the mouth deepened to dimples all the same. My boyfriend's real name is John Sullivan, she said, like the fighter. Now tell me the name of your girlfriend. Anne Marie, I said, not much caring for the sound of it as it came out of my mouth. Anne Marie Susie, she's a senior at Gates Falls High this year. I let Carol go. When I did, she took her hands off my chest and grabbed mine. This is information, she said. Information. That's all. Still want to kiss me? I nodded. I wanted to more than ever. Okay. She tilted her face up, closed her eyes, opened her lips a little. She looked like a kid waiting at the foot of the stairs for her goodnight kiss from Papa. It was so cute, I almost laughed. Instead, I bent and kissed her. She kissed back with pleasure and enthusiasm. There were no tongues touching, but it was a thorough, searching kiss just the same. When she drew back, her cheeks were flushed and her eyes were bright. Good night. Thanks for the movie. Want to do it again? I have to think about that, she said. She was smiling, but her eyes were serious. I suppose her boyfriend was on her mind. I know that Anne-Marie was on mine. Maybe you better, too. I'll see you on the dish line Monday. What do you have? Lunch and dinner. I have breakfast and lunch, so I'll see you at lunch. Eat more main beans, I said. That made her laugh. She went inside. I watched her go, standing outside with my collar turned up and my hands in my pockets and a cigarette between my lips, feeling like Bogey. I watched her say something to the girl on the reception desk and then hurry upstairs, still laughing. I walked back to Chamberlain in the moonlight, determined to get serious about the geosyncline. I only went into the third floor lounge to get my geology book. I swear it's true. When I got there, every table, plus one or two which must have been hijacked from other floors, was occupied by a quartet of hearts-playing fools. There was even a group in the corner, sitting cross-legged on the floor and staring intently at their cards. They looked like half-assed yogis. "We chasing the cunt," Ronnie Malenfant yelled to the room at large. "We gotta bust that bitch out, boys." I picked up my geology text from the sofa where it had lain all day and night. Someone had sat on it, pushing it most of the way down between two cushions, but that baby was too big to hide entirely. And looked at it the way you might look at some artifact of unknown purpose. In Hauk Auditorium, sitting beside Carol Gerber, this crazy card party had seemed like a dream. Now it was Carol who seemed dreamlike. Carol with her dimples and her boyfriend with a boxer's name. I still had $6 in my pocket, and it was absurd to feel disappointed just because there was no place for me in any of the games currently going on. Study, that was what I had to do, make friends with the geosyncline. I'd camp out in the second floor lounge or maybe find a quiet corner in the basement rec. Just as I was leaving with historical geology under my arm, Kirby McClendon tossed down his cards and cried, "Fuck this! I'm tapped, all because I keep getting hit with that fucking queen of spades. I'll give you guys IOUs, but I am honest to God tapped out." He went out past me without looking back, ducking his head as he went through the door. I've always thought that being that tall must be a kind of curse. A month later, Kirby would be tapped out in a much larger sense, withdrawn from the university by his frightened parents after a mental breakdown and a half-assed suicide attempt. Not the first victim of Hart's mania that fall, nor the last, but the only one to try and off himself by eating 2 bottles of orange-flavored baby aspirin. Lenny Doria didn't even bother looking after him. He looked over at me instead. "You want to sit in, Riley?" A brief but perfectly genuine struggle for my soul went on. I needed to study. I had planned on studying. And for a financial aid boy like me, that was a good plan, certainly more sensible than sitting here in this smoky room and adding the effluent from my own Pall Malls to the general fug. So I said, "Yeah, why not?" and sat down and played hearts until almost 1 in the morning. When I finally shambled back to my room, Nate was lying on his bed reading his Bible. That was the last thing he did every night before going to sleep. This was his 3rd trip through what he always called the Word of God, he told me. He'd reached the book of Nehemiah. He looked up at me with an expression of calm inquiry, a look that never changed much. Now that I think about it, Nate never changed much. He was in pre-dent, and he stayed with it. Tucked into his last Christmas card to me was a photo of his new office in Holton. In the photo, there are 3 magi standing around a straw-filled cradle on the snowy office lawn. Behind Mary and Joseph, you can read the sign on the door. Nathaniel Hoppenstand, DDS. He married Cindy. They are still married, and their three children are mostly grown up. I imagine Rinty died and got replaced. "Did you win?" Nate asked. He spoke in almost the same tone of voice my wife would use some years later when I came home half drunk after a Thursday night poker game. Actually, I did. I had gravitated to a table where Ronnie was playing and had lost three of my remaining $6, then drifted to another one where I won them back, and a couple of more besides. But I had never gotten around to the geosyncline or the mysteries of tectonic plates. Nate was wearing red and white striped pajamas. He was, I think, the only person I ever shared a room with in college, male or female, who wore pajamas. Of course, he was also the only one who owned Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue. As I began undressing, Nate slipped between the covers of his bed and reached behind him to turn off the study lamp on his desk. "Got your geology all studied up?" he asked as the shadow swallowed his half of the room. "I'm in good shape with it," I said. Years later, when I came in from those late poker games and my wife would ask me how drunk I was, I'd say, "I only had a couple," in that same chipper tone of voice. I swung into my own bed, turned off my own light, and was asleep almost immediately. I dreamed I was playing hearts. Ronnie Malenfant was dealing. Stoke Jones stood in the lounge doorway, hunched over his crutches and eyeing me, eyeing all of us with the dour disapproval of a Massachusetts Bay Colony Puritan. In my dream, there was an enormous amount of money lying on the table, hundreds of dollars in crumpled fives and ones, money orders, even a personal check or two. I looked at this, then back at the doorway. Carol Gerber was now standing on one side of Stokely. Nate, dressed in his candy cane pajamas, was on the other side. "We want information," Carol said. "You won't get it," I replied. In the TV show, that was always Patrick McGoohan's reply to number two. Nate said, "You left your window open, Pete. The room's cold and your paper's blue everywhere." I couldn't think of an adequate reply to this, so I picked up the hand I'd been dealt and fanned it open. 13 cards, and every one was the Queen of Spades. Every one was La Femme Noire. Every one was the bitch. In Vietnam, the war was going well. Lyndon Johnson, on a swing through the South Pacific, said so. There were a few minor setbacks, however. The Viet Cong shot down three American Hueys practically in Saigon's backyard. A little further out from Big S, an estimated 1,000 Viet Cong soldiers kicked the shit out of at least twice that number of South Vietnamese regulars. In the Mekong Delta, U.S. gunships sank 120 Viet Cong river patrol boats, which turned out to contain, whoops, large numbers of refugee children. America lost its 400th plane of the war that October, an F-105 Thunder Chief. The pilot parachuted to safety. In Manila, South Vietnam's Prime Minister, Nguyen Cao Ky, insisted that he was not a crook. Neither were the members of his cabinet, he said, and the fact that a dozen or so cabinet members resigned while Ky was in the Philippines was just coincidence. In San Diego, Bob Hope did a show for Army boys headed in-country. "I wanted to call Bing and send him along with you," Bob said, "but that pipe-smoking son of a gun has unlisted his number." The Army boys roared with laughter. Question Mark and the Mysterians ruled the radio. Their song, 96 Tears, was a monster hit. They never had another one. In Honolulu, hula hula girls greeted President Johnson. At the UN, Secretary General U Thant was pleading with American Representative Arthur Goldberg to stop, at least temporarily, the bombing of North Vietnam. Arthur Goldberg got in touch with the Great White Father in Hawaii to relay Thant's request. The Great White Father, perhaps still wearing his lei, said no way, we'd stop when the Viet Cong stopped. But in the meantime, they were going to cry 96 tears, at least 96. Johnson did a brief, clumsy shimmy with the Hula Hula Girls. I remember watching that on the Huntley Brinkley Report and thinking he danced like every other white guy I knew, which was, incidentally, all the guys I knew. In Greenwich Village, a peace march was broken up by the police. The marchers had no permit, the police said. In San Francisco, war protesters carrying plastic skulls on sticks and wearing whiteface like a troop of mimes were dispersed by tear gas. In Denver, police tore down thousands of posters advertising an anti-war rally at Chautauqua Park in Boulder. The police had discovered a statute forbidding the posting of such bills. The statute did not, the Denver chief said, forbid posted bills which advertised movies, old clothes drives, VFW dances, or rewards for information leading to the recovery of lost pets. Those posters, the chief explained, were not political. On our own little patch, there was a sit-in at East Annex, where Coleman Chemicals was holding job interviews. Coleman, like Dow, made napalm. Coleman also made Agent Orange, botulin compound, and anthrax, it turned out, although no one knew that until the company went bankrupt in 1980. In the main campus, there was a small picture of the protesters being led away. A larger photo showed one protester being pulled out of the East Annex doorway by a campus cop, while another cop stood by, holding the protester's crutches. Said protester was Stoke Jones, of course, wearing his duffel coat with the sparrow track on the back. The cops were treating him kindly enough, I'm sure. At that point, war protesters were still more novelty than nuisance. But the combination of the big cop and the staggering boy made the picture creepy somehow. I thought of it many times between 1968 and 1971, years when, in the words of Bob Dylan, the game got rough. The largest photo in that issue, the only one above the fold, showed ROTC guys in uniform marching on the sunny football field while large crowds watched. "Maneuvers draw a record crowd," read the headline. Closer to home still, one Peter Riley got a D on his geology quiz and a D-plus on a sociology quiz 2 days later. On Friday, I got back a one-page essay of opinion I had scribbled just before intro English writing on Monday morning. The subject was, ties should not be required for men in restaurants. I had chosen should not. This little expository exercise had been marked with a big red C, the first C I'd gotten in English since arriving at U of M with my straight A's in high school English and my 740 score on the SAT verbals. That red hook shocked me in a way the quiz D's hadn't, and angered me as well. Across the top, Mr. Babcock had written, "Your usual clarity is present, but in this case serves only to show what a meatless meal this is. Your humor, although facile, falls far short of wit. The sea is actually something of a gift. Sloppy work." I thought of approaching him after class, then rejected the idea. Mr. Babcock, who wore bow ties and big horn-rimmed glasses, had made it clear in just 4 weeks that he considered grade grubbers the lowest form of academic life. Also, it was noon. If I grabbed a quick bite at the Palace on the Plains, I could be back on Chamberlain 3 by 1. All the tables in the lounge and all four corners of the room would be filled by 3 o'clock that afternoon, but at 1 I'd still be able to find a seat. I was almost $20 to the good by then and planned to spend a profitable late October weekend lining my pockets. I was also planning on the Saturday night dance at Lengel Gym. Carol had agreed to go with me. The Cumberlands, a popular campus group, were playing. At some point, more likely at several points, they would do their version of 96 Tears. The voice of conscience, already speaking in the tones of Nate Hoppenstand, suggested I'd do well to spend at least part of the weekend hitting the books. I had 2 chapters of geology to read, 2 chapters of sociology, 40 pages of history, the Middle Ages at a gulp, plus a set of questions to answer concerning trade routes. "I'll get to it. Don't worry, I'll get to it," I told that voice. "Sunday's my day to study. You can count on it. You can take it to the bank." And for a while on Sunday, I actually did read about in-groups, out-groups, and group sanctions. Between hands of cards, I read about them. Then things got interesting, and my Soch book ended up on the floor under the couch. Going to bed on Sunday night, late Sunday night, it occurred to me that not only had my winning shrunk instead of grown, Ronnie now seemed actually to be seeking me out, but I hadn't really gotten very far with my studying. Also, I hadn't made a certain phone call. "If you really want to put your hand there," Carol said, and she had been smiling that funny little smile when she said it, that smile which was mostly dimples and a look in the eyes. "If you really want to put your hand there." About halfway through the Saturday night dance, she and I had gone out for a smoke. It was a mild night, and along Lengel's brick north side, maybe 20 couples were hugging and kissing by the light of the moon rising over Chadbourne Hall. Carol and I joined them. Before long, I had my hand inside her sweater. I rubbed my thumb over the smooth cotton of her bra cup, feeling the stiff little rise of her nipple. My temperature was also rising. I could feel hers rising as well. She looked into my face with her arms still locked around my neck and said, "If you really want to put your hand there, I think you owe somebody a phone call, don't you?" "There's time," I told myself as I drifted towards sleep. "There's plenty of time for studying, plenty of time for phone calls, plenty of time." Skip Kirk blew an anthropology quiz, ended up guessing at half of the answers and getting a 58. He got a C- on an advanced calc quiz and only did that well because his last math course in high school had covered some of the same concepts. We were in the same sociology course and he got a D- on the quiz, scoring a bare 70. And we weren't the only ones with problems. Ronnie was a winner at hearts, better than 50 bucks up in 10 days of play, if you believed him. No one completely did, although we knew he was winning. But a loser in his classes. He flunked a French quiz, blew off the little English paper in the class we shared. "Who gives a fuck about ties? I eat at McDonald's," he said. And scraped through a quiz in some other history division by scanning an admirer's notes just before class. Kirby McClendon had quit shaving and began gnawing his fingernails between deals. He also began cutting significant numbers of classes. Jack Frady convinced his advisor to let him drop Statistics 1, even though ad drop was officially over. "I cried a little," he told me matter-of-factly one night in the lounge as we bitch-hunted our way toward the wee hours. "It's something I learned to do in dramatics club." Lenny Doria tapped on my door a couple of nights later while I was cramming. Nate had been in the rack for an hour or more, sleeping the sleep of the just and the caught up, and asked me if I had any interest in writing a paper about Crispus Atticus. He had heard I could do such things. He'd pay a fair price, Lenny said. He was currently 10 bucks up in the game. I said I was sorry, but I couldn't help him. I was behind a couple of papers myself. Lenny nodded and slipped out. Ashley Rice broke out in horrible, oozing acne all over his face. Mark St. Pierre had a sleepwalking interlude after losing almost 20 bucks in one catastrophic night, and Brad Witherspoon got into a fight with a guy on the first floor. The guy made some innocuous little crack. Later on, Brad himself admitted it had been innocuous. But Brad, who'd just been hit with the bitch 3 times in 4 hands and only wanted a Coke out of the first-floor machine to soothe his butt-parched throat, wasn't in an innocuous mood. He turned, dropped his unopened soda into the sandwell of a nearby cigarette urn and started punching, broke the kid's glasses, loosened one of his teeth. So Brad Witherspoon, ordinarily about as dangerous as a library mimeograph, was the first of us to go on disciplinary pro. I thought about calling Anne Marie and telling her I had met someone and was dating, but it seemed like a lot of work, a lot of psychic effort on top of everything else. I settled for hoping that she'd write me a letter saying that she thought it was time we started seeing other people. Instead, I got one saying how much she missed me and that she was making me something special for Christmas, which probably meant a sweater, one with reindeer on it. Reindeer sweaters were an Anne Marie specialty. Those slow, stroking hand jobs were another. She enclosed a picture of herself in a short skirt. Looking at it made me feel not horny, but tired and guilty and put upon. Carol also made me feel put upon. I had wanted a cop a feel, that was all. That changed my whole fucking life. Or hers, for that matter. But I liked her. That was true. A lot. That smile of hers and her sharp wit. This is getting good, she had said. We're exchanging information like mad. A week or so later, I returned from Holyoke, where I'd worked lunch with her on the dish line, and saw Frank Stewart walking slowly down the third floor hallway with his trunk hung from his hands. Frank was from western Maine, one of those little unincorporated townships that are practically all trees, and had a Yankee accent so thick you could slice it. He was just a so-so Hearts player, usually ducking in second or a close third when somebody else went over the 100-point mark, but a hell of a nice guy. He always had a smile on his face, at least until the afternoon I came upon him headed for the stairwell with his trunk. "You moving rooms, Frank?" I asked. But even then I thought I knew better. It was in the look on his face, serious and pale and downcast. He shook his head. "Going back home. Got a letter from my ma. She says they need a caretaker at one of those big lake resorts we got over our way. I said, sure, I'm just wasting my time here." "You are not," I said, a little shocked. "Christ, Frankie, you're getting a college education." "I ain't, though, that's the thing." The hall was gloomy and choked with shadows. It was raining outside. Still, I think I saw color come flushing into Frank's cheeks. I think he was ashamed. I think that was why he'd arranged to leave in the middle of a weekday, when the dorm was at its emptiest. "I ain't doing nothing but playing cards. Not very well, either. Also, I'm behind in all my classes."
"You can't be that far behind. It's only October 25th.
Frank nodded. "I know, but I ain't quick like some. Wasn't quick in high school, either. I got to set my feet and bore in like with an ice auger. I ain't been doing it, and if you ain't got a hole in the ice, you can't catch any perch. I'm going, Pete. Gonna quit before they fire me in January."
He went on, plodding down the first of the three flights with his trunk held in front of him by the handles. His white T-shirt floated in the gloom. When he passed a window running with rain, his crew cut glimmered like gold. As he reached the second floor landing and his footfalls began to take on an echoey beat, I rushed to the stairwell and looked down.
"Frankie! Hey, Frank!"
The footfalls stopped. In the shadows, I could see his round face looking up at me and the dim-held shape of his trunk.
"Frank, what about the draft? If you drop out of school, the draft'll get you."
A long pause, as if he was thinking how to answer. He never did, not with his mouth. He answered with his feet. Their echoey sound resumed. I never saw Frank again. I remember standing by the stairwell, scared, thinking, that could happen to me. Maybe is happening to me. Then pushing the thought away. Seeing Frank with his trunk was a warning, I decided, and I would heed it. I would do better. I had been coasting, and it was time to turn on the jets again. But from down the hall, I could hear Ronnie yelling gleefully that he was bitch-hunting, that he meant to have that whore out of hiding. And I decided I would do better starting tonight. Tonight would be time enough to relight those fabled jets. This afternoon, I'd play my farewell game of hearts. Or 2. Or 40. It was years before I isolated the key part of my final conversation with Frank Stewart. I had told him he couldn't be so far behind so soon, and he had replied that it happened because he wasn't a quick study. We were both wrong. It was possible to fall catastrophically behind in a short period of time, and it happened to the quick studies like me and Skip and Mark St. Pierre, as well as to the plodders. In the backs of our minds, we must have been holding on to the idea that we'd be able to loaf and then spurt, loaf and then spurt, which was the way most of us had gone through our dozy hometown high schools. But as Deary Dearborn had pointed out, this wasn't high school. I told you that of the 32 students who began the fall semester on our floor of Chamberlain, 33 if you count Deary, but he was immune to the charms of hearts. Only 15 remained to start the spring semester. That doesn't mean the 19 who left were all dopes, though, not by any means. In fact, the smartest fellows on Chamberlain 3 in the fall of 1966 were probably the ones who transferred before flunking out became a real possibility. Steve Ogg and Jack Frady, who had the room just up the hall from Nate and me, went to Chadbourne the first week in November, citing distractions on their joint application. When the housing officer asked what sort of distractions, they said it was the usual. All-night bull sessions, toothpaste ambushes in the head, abrasive relations with a couple of the guys. As an afterthought, both added they were probably playing cards in the lounge a little too much. They'd heard Chad was a quieter environment, one of the campus's two or three brain dorms. The housing officer's question had been anticipated. The answer is carefully rehearsed as an oral presentation in a speech class. Neither Steve nor Jack wanted the nearly endless hearts games shut down. That might cause them all sorts of grief from people who believed folks should mind their own business. All they wanted was to get the fuck off Chamberlain 3 while there was still time to salvage their scholarships. The bad quizzes and unsuccessful little papers were nothing but unpleasant skirmishes. For Skip and me and too many of our card-playing buddies, our second round of prelims was a full-fledged disaster. I got an A-minus on my in-class English theme and a D in European history, but flunked the sociology multiple choicer and the geology multiple choicer, soc by a little and geo by a lot. Skip flunked his anthropology prelim, his colonial history prelim, and the soc prelim. He got a C on the calculus test, but the ice was getting pretty thin there too, he told me, and a B on his in-class essay. We agreed that life would be much simpler if it were all a matter of in-class essays, writing assignments which necessarily took place far from the third-floor lounge. We were wishing for high school, in other words, without even knowing it. "Okay, that's enough," Skip said to me that Friday night. "I'm buckling down, Peter. I don't give a shit about being a college man or having a diploma to hang over the mantle in my rumpus room, but I'll be fucked if I want to go back to Dexter and hang around fucking Bolarama with the rest of the retards until Uncle Sam calls me." He was sitting on Nate's bed. Nate was across the way at the Palace on the Plains, chowing down on Friday night fish. It was nice to know somebody on Chamberlain 3 had an appetite. This was a conversation we couldn't have around Nate in any case. My country mouse roommate thought he'd done pretty well on the latest round of prelims, all C's and B's. He wouldn't have said anything if he'd heard us talking, but would have looked at us in a way that said we lacked gumption, that although it might not be our fault, we were morally weak. "I'm with you," I said, and then from down the hall came an agonized cry, "Oh, fuck me," that we recognized instantly. Someone had just taken the bitch. Our eyes met. I can't say about Skip, not for sure, even though he was my best friend in college. But I was still thinking that there was time. And why wouldn't I think that? For me, there always had been. Skip began to grin. I began to grin. Skip began to giggle, I began to giggle right along with him.
What the fuck, he said.
Just tonight, I said. We'll go over to the library together tomorrow.
Hit the books.
All day, but right now.
He stood up. Let's go bitch hunting.
We did. And we weren't the only ones. That's no explanation, I know. It's only what happened. At breakfast the next morning, as we worked side by side on the dish line, Carol said, I'm hearing there's some kind of big card game going on in your dorm. Is that true?
I guess it is, I said.
She looked at me over her shoulder, giving me that smile, the one I always thought about when I thought about Carol, the one I think about still. Hearts? Hunting the bitch?
Hearts, I agreed, hunting the bitch.
I heard that some guys are getting in over their heads, getting in grades trouble.
I guess that might be, I said.
Nothing was coming down the conveyor belt, not so much as a single tray. There's never a rush when you need one, I've noticed. How are your grades? She asked. I know it's none of my business, but I want...
Information. Yeah, I know. I'm doing okay. Besides, I'm getting out of the game.
She gave me the smile, and sure, I still think about it sometimes. You would, too. The dimples, the slightly curved lower lip that knew so many nice things about kissing, the dancing blue eyes. Those were days when no girl saw further into a boy's dorm than the lobby, and vice versa, of course. Still, I have an idea that for a little while in October and November of 1966, Carol saw plenty, more than I did. But of course, she wasn't insane. At least, not then. The war in Vietnam became her insanity. Mine as well, and Skip's, and Nate's. Hearts were nothing, really, only a few tremors in the earth, the kind that flapped the screen door on its hinges and rattled the glasses on the shelves. The killer earthquake, the apocalyptic continent drowner, was still on its way. Barry Margot and Brad Witherspoon both got the Dairy News delivered to their rooms, and the two copies had usually made the rounds of the third floor by the end of the day. We'd find the remnants in the lounge when we took our seats for the evening session of Hearts, the pages torn and out of order, the crossword filled in by three or four different hands. There would be mustaches inked on the photo dot faces of Lyndon Johnson and Ramsey Clark and Martin Luther King. Someone, I never found out who, would invariably put large smoking horns on Vice President Humphrey and print Hubert the Devil underneath in tiny anal capital letters. The news was hawkish on the war, putting the most positive spin on each day's military events and relegating any protest news to the depths, usually beneath the community calendar. Yet more and more, we found ourselves discussing not movies or dates or classes as the cards were shuffled and dealt. More and more, it was Vietnam. No matter how good the news or how high the Kong body count, there always seemed to be at least one picture of agonized U.S. soldiers after an ambush or crying Vietnamese children watching their village go up in smoke. There was always some unsettling detail tucked away near the bottom of what Skip called the daily kill column, like the thing about the kids who got wasted when we hit the Kong PT boats in the Delta. Nate, of course, didn't play cards. He wouldn't debate the pros and cons of the war, either. I doubt if he knew, any more than I did, that Vietnam had once been under the French, or what had happened to the messieurs, unlucky enough to have been in the fortress city of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, let alone who might have decided it was time for President Diem to go to that big rice paddy in the sky so that Nguyen Cao Ky and the generals could take over.
Nate only knew that he had no quarrel with those Kongs, that they weren't going to be in Mars Hill or Presque Isle in the immediate future. "Haven't you ever heard about the domino theory, shitbird?" a bandy little freshman named Nicholas Prouty asked Nate one afternoon. My roommate rarely came down to the third-floor lounge now, preferring the quieter one on two, but that day he had dropped in for a few moments. Nate looked at Nick Prouty, a lobsterman's son who had become a devout disciple of Ronnie Malenfant, and sighed. "When the dominoes come out, I leave the room. I think it's a boring game. That's my domino theory." He shot me a glance. I got my eyes away as fast as I could, but not quite in time to avoid the message. "What in hell's wrong with you?" Then he left, scuffing back down to room 302 in his fuzzy slippers to do some more studying, to resume his charted course from pre-dent to dent, in other words. "Riley, your roommate's fucked, you know that?" Ronnie said. He had a cigarette tucked in the corner of his mouth. Now he scratched a match one-handed, a specialty of his. College guys, too ugly and abrasive to get girls, have all sorts of specialties. And lit up. "No, man," I thought. "Nate's doing fine. We're the ones who are fucked up." For a second, I felt real despair. In that second, I realized I was in a terrible jam and had no idea at all of how to extricate myself. I was aware of Skip looking at me. And it occurred to me that if I snatched up the cards, sprayed them in Ronnie's face, and walked out of the room, Skip would join me, likely with relief. Then the feeling passed. It passed as rapidly as it had come. "Nate's okay," I said. "He's got some funny ideas, that's all." "Some funny communist ideas is what he's got," Hugh Brennan said. His older brother was in the Navy and most recently heard from in the South China Sea. Hugh had no use for peaceniks. As a Goldwater Republican, I should have felt the same, but Nate had started getting to me. I had all sorts of canned knowledge, but no real arguments in favor of the war, nor time to work any up. I was too busy to study my sociology, let alone to bone up on U.S. foreign policy. I'm pretty sure that was the night I almost called Anne-Marie Susie. The phone booth across from the lounge was empty. I had a pocket full of change from my latest victory in the Hearts Wars, and I suddenly decided the time had come. I dialed her number from memory, although I had to think for a moment about the last four digits. Were they 8146 or 8164? And plugged in three quarters when the operator asked for them. I let the phone ring a single time, then racked the receiver with a bang and retrieved my quarters when I heard them rattle into the return. A day or two later, shortly before Halloween, Nate got an album by a guy I'd only vaguely heard of, Phil Oakes, a folky, but not the blunk-blunk banjo kind who used to show up on Hootenanny. The album cover, which showed a rumpled troubadour sitting on a curb in New York City, went oddly with the covers of Nate's other records, Dean Martin looking tipsy in a tux, Mitch Miller with his sing-along smile, Diane Renee in her midi blouse and perky sailor cap. The Oaks record was called I Ain't Marchin' Anymore, and Nate played it a lot as the days shortened and turned chilly. I took to playing it myself, and Nate didn't seem to mind. There was a kind of baffled anger in Oakes's voice. I suppose I liked it because most of the time I felt pretty baffled myself. He was like Dylan, but less complicated in his expression and clearer in his rage. The best song on the album, also the most troubling, was the title song. In that song, Oakes didn't just suggest, but came right out and said that war wasn't worth it. War was never worth it. Even when it was worth it, it wasn't worth it. This idea, coupled with the image of young men just walking away from Lyndon and his Vietnam obsession by the thousands and tens of thousands, excited my imagination in a way that had nothing to do with history or policy or rational thought. I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore, Phil Oakes sang through the speaker of Nate's nifty little swingline phono. Just quit it, in other words.
Quit doing what they say. Quit doing what they want. Quit playing their game. It's an old game, and in this one, the bitch is hunting you. And maybe to show you mean it, you start wearing a symbol of your resistance, something others will first wonder about and then perhaps rally to. It was a couple of days after Halloween that Nate Hoppenstein showed us what the symbol was going to be. Finding out started with one of those crumpled leftover newspapers in the third floor lounge. "Son of a bitch, look at this," Billy Marchant said. Harvey Twiller was shuffling the cards at Billy's table. Lenny Doria was adding up the current score, and Billy was taking the opportunity to do a quick scan through of the news's local section. Kirby McClendon, unshaven, tall and twitchy, well on his way to his date with all those baby aspirants, leaned in to take a look. Billy drew back from him, fluttering a hand in front of his face. "Jesus, Kerb, when did you take your last shower? Columbus Day? 4th of July? "Let me see," Kirby said, ignoring him. He snatched the paper away. "Fuck, that's rip-rip." Ronnie Malenfant got up so fast his chair fell over, entranced by the idea that Stoke had made the paper. When college kids showed up in the Derry News, except on the sports page, of course, it was always because they were in trouble. Others gathered around Kirby, Skip and me among them. It was Stokely Jones III, all right, and not just him. Standing in the background, their faces almost but not quite lost in the clusters of dots. "Christ," Skip said. "I think that's Nate." He sounded amused and astonished. "And that's Carol Gerber, just up ahead of him," I said in a funny, shocked voice. I knew the jacket with Harwich High School on the back, knew the blonde hair hanging over the jacket's collar in a ponytail, knew the faded jeans. And I knew the face. Even half turned away and shadowed by a sign reading, "U.S. out of Vietnam now," I knew the face. That's my girlfriend. It was the first time the word girlfriend had come out of my mouth tied to Carol's name, although I had been thinking of her that way for a couple of weeks at least. "Police break up draft protest," the photo caption read. No names were given. According to the accompanying story, a dozen or so protesters from the University of Maine had gathered in front of the federal building in downtown Derry. They had carried signs and marched around the entrance to the Selective Service Office for about an hour, singing songs and chanting slogans, some obscene. Police had been called and had at first only stood by, intending to allow the demonstration to run its course. But then an opposing group of demonstrators had turned up, mostly construction workers on their lunch break. They had begun chanting their own slogans, and although the news didn't mention if they were obscene or not, I could guess there had been invitations to go back to Russia, suggestions as to where the demonstrators could store their signs while not in use, and directions to the nearest barber shop. When the protesters began to shout back at the construction workers and the construction workers began firing pieces of fruit from their dinner buckets at the protesters, the police had stepped in. Citing the protesters' lack of a permit, the Derry cops had apparently never heard about the right of Americans to assemble peaceably. They rounded up the kids and took them to the police substation on Wycham Street. There they were simply released. "We only wanted to get them out of a bad atmosphere," one cop was quoted as saying. "If they go back down there, they're even dumber than they look." The photo really wasn't much different from the one taken at East Annex during the Coleman Chemicals protest. It showed the cops leading the protesters away while construction workers, a year or so later, they would all be sporting small American flags on their hard hats, jeered and grinned and shook their fists. One cop was frozen in the act of reaching out toward Carol's arm. Nate, standing behind her, had not attracted their attention, it seemed. Two more cops were escorting Stoke Jones, who was back to the camera but unmistakable on his crutches. If any further aid to identification was needed, there was that hand-drawn sparrow track on his jacket. "Look at that dumb fuck," Ronnie crowed. Ronnie, who had flunked 2 of 4 on the last round of prelims, had a nerve calling anyone a dumb fuck.
like you didn't have anything better to do.
Skip ignored him. So did I. For us, Ronnie's bluster was already fading into insignificance, no matter what the subject. We were fascinated by the sight of Carol and of Nate Hoppenstand behind her, watching as the demonstration